Hello, everybody.
This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home.
Happy Sunday.
It's February 19th, 2023, and spring is coming. So, spring's a major one for me, because my birthday is March 20th, which I think most of the time lines up with what is called the spring equinox. The equinox is when there's equal parts 12 hours day and 12 hours, you know, night. And it was hard for me to realize a trend within myself when I was growing up, but I do the best in the spring. Like, I'm not quite the most fond of summer, but I would definitely prefer summer to winter. I go through this little tumble during the winter where I have to have these crises of motivation. There's an acronym, SAD, which stands for Seasonal Affect Disorder, which has been linked, showing that there is a marked reduction in serotonin production because vitamin D is very important for the facilitation of the creation of this important neurotransmitter in our physiology. And so when we have less sunlight, our body produces less vitamin D, and people with vitamin D deficiencies are going to have, or at least going to have, tendencies to be more inclined to have, you know, serotonin disorders, I would assume, in some way. And serotonin is a base molecule that is very understood and misunderstood, because the world of neuropsychology is so vast, and I've heard it described, it's like pointing a telescope towards the stars and expecting to be able to understand the universe off of pinpoints of light. There's just bajillions of things, and there's so much going on in the human brain with consciousness. But I do notice that during the winter, I do get a little sadder. And, you know, and I have to pick myself up again every year. And last year, I started going outside more. And I found that I really loved just walking around in nature, and Colorado happens to be one of the most beautiful places on this planet. And I am so excited and encouraged by the fact that I'm going to be able to go outside more soon, just because spring's almost here. You know, and when I was younger and all I wanted to do was play video games and watch TV, it was probably a lot less likely that I noticed these things, because I was doing the same thing every single day, basically, you know. And I did go outside to go hiking just a couple weeks ago, but that's how it is that there's just those couple moments of free time. And if the opportunity's right and the weather looks nice, I just go outside when that opportunity arises. And in the winter, that's just so much less likely. So I want to embrace this springtime, and it's not a celebration of me, it's more of a celebration of, you know, the spring back to life of everything, you know. And I find that exciting, even here, even though my ecosystem of Colorado is considered like a desert plain, like a high steppe area, like it's very dry here, you know. But even then, during the spring, there's always this influx of flowers that always come, and I find it exhilarating. And in the past, I would take pictures of these flowers, and, you know, and I can't wait to go walk around and see them all. And I hope you're excited too. And even if you're not, perhaps there's another moment, some cathartic and some sort of catalytic moment for you that is coming in your life at some point that might not have anything to do with what makes me excited. But we all have these trends, and it makes me think of when I was younger, the spring cleaning phenomena. So, like, I usually do really good at keeping my house up and keeping my house clean and keeping it, you know. But that's a lot more difficult to do when it's you know, snowy and shitty outside all the time. Like, especially where my apartment's located, you consistently have to walk through snow and salt. And so my floors are fucked, and I haven't cleaned my floors in quite a while, you know? And I'm not even trying to feel guilty about it because spring's kind of be coming, and I'm looking forward to a weekend or two of just deep cleaning the house, you know? And I just know that I'm going to have the energy to do it just because of those inner systems, you know? And I'm sharing this story just to try to give you a glimpse of the introspection that I'm doing towards my own systems in response to my environment. You know, we have a lot of control, as I've spoken about often, on our own reactions and our own subjective, perceptive feedback loops that we can do to help create our reality. But we are also responsive creatures, and we respond in that way to our environment. And our environment can be a myriad of different forms. The world could be thought of as this blanket environment with a universe blanket over that. But we each have our own niche in societies and within our own families. And there are expectations based upon that. And when I'm looking at the seasons and I'm looking at my own excitements, these are me responding to the environment that I'm given. And recreation's a lot easier to introspect about because it's pleasurable and fun. But we are also responsive to the different roles that we have. And say, like, here's one that I've used before, and I'm going to bring it up again. When you're walking down a sidewalk, you know, or even I've found it is even more dramatic going up, like, say, a staircase or like even like a curly staircase with very little room, but you're crowded. It's natural to go to the right side in America, and it might be opposite in places where there's different directionality, like people drive on the different sides of the road. But there is an inclination towards one side or the other that is unspoken. And so we meet this expectation generally subconsciously. And if we break it, there are reprimandations for such behavior. And a lot of this idea stuff comes from my Irving Goffman book, The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life, which I quoted last week, and I might read another quote out of today. But he calls it decorum. You know, manners is our own output, and decorum is our responsiveness. And we have all of these different zones and regions where we might act or act indifferently. And on a big scale, you know, the time of year, our regions, you know, when we have holiday times, it's going to be different even at work or in recreation and how much free time we have and what we can or cannot enjoy. So even seasons are these big regions, but it could be even more dramatic and say, like, my workplace is a kitchen, and there can sometimes be a very openness in the kitchen because, like, yesterday I was getting some lunch at Panda Express, which is basically like ice cream chicken. It's just so sweet and so good. But, like, you could see everybody there, there's nowhere to hide. There's like a little tiny prep area, and you could pretty much see that, but everybody's cooking all the like cafeteria style. Bins of food are all open and seeable, and you know, so it's like the customer is very involved in their workspace. And so you'd have to act a lot differently than, say, if you're at like a fancy restaurant where they have those kick doors that are soundproof, and so as soon as they go into the back of the house, you can't hear anybody. You know, even it could be incredibly loud back there, but there's a distinction between the front and the back of the house. And I really like this metaphor, and I know it's personal for myself that might not be as relatable to other people who have not worked in a kitchen, but consider the front and the back of your own home. Like, when you have people over, your bedroom is like the back of house, and usually like that door might not be as available. I've been prone to bringing people into my bedroom for some reason, not in like a weird way, you know, like a very platonic way. But, you know, like my books have tended to be in my bedroom, and that's where I smoke. And so, like, if people are over, they end up in my room at some point, and it's not like, but in like fucking sitcom America, like 1960s, 1970s, when you have the gender roles that are very established, and you have Miss Nancy, who's the housewife, and the father who comes home and does no housework at all, you know, all that weird bullshit. Like, in that situation, how often do you think in that sitcom they'd be bringing back their guests, you know, like, even if they're having, like, their boss over for a work dinner? So that's, like, a common trope that you see in these shows. But, like, it's not often. And like, I don't feel comfortable walking into my parents' room when I go to their house. You know, I don't feel, I'm like, if I come to your house, I'm not going to go walk into your room. You know, like that's, it's not often. Like, and most people that come into my room, I like invite them in. I'm like, hey, come on, you want to go smoke? You want to look at my books? You know, like nobody's just walking into the house and like, hey, I feel comfortable going right there. It just doesn't happen. And so we even have a back of house in our homes. And this might lead to further diversification of our roles, is how I'm looking at it from this vantage point. So let's tie that metaphor up. And strictly vocational circumstances and in our personal lives, we have a split between the front of our show and the back of our show. And the show is the role that we are putting on in that current moment. As humans, we have a lot of different roles and a lot of different faces that we can show people, you know, just to wrap that together. And for any long-term listeners of the show, I know I repeat myself a lot, but it's worth it. And good stories do have to go around in circles. Anywho, with spring in the air, I have been feeling invigorated, and I'm excited, and it makes me think about all the things that I want to do for this show and all the new projects that I want to start. I'm excited for you too, you know. I hope you live in a beautiful place where you can go outside if you like to do that. But what sort of things do you respond to? Are there places where you find yourself further away from that back of house behavior? I would hazard to say that we're more comfortable when we're in that zone. And this can make it challenging for those who are persistently in a front of house face, like the Panda Express workers. And then again, I think that there's people who start to blend them together. I think I lose it a lot. And I know people respond to me weird even at work, because like I go deliver food to people, you know, and I never act weird, and I never put on that false face. Sometimes I'll put on a big smile. It's not like it's a false face by a long shot in any way. But I feel this blending between the front and the back of my performance. And what happens when our ability to perform is stripped away? I think that psychedelic compounds, which is one of my favorite tools for investigating myself, have the ability to completely knock away all of that intentionality. And I think it's been a spontaneous catalyst to my blending of fronts. I had a phenomenal day yesterday. And I took a pretty large amount, about 2.5 grams of Treasure Coast mushrooms, which Florida has an abundant natural population of psilocybin mushrooms. I don't know if they are natural there. It seems like it. And throughout much of the South, because of the climate, I think, and because there's more poop on the ground and they're dung lovers, and a lot of the time psilocybes are found around poop or they're found in wood chips. Some of them are mycorrhizal, which means that they form partnerships with trees. So they need to be around tree populations. So they come in certain types of years, like Amanita muscaria, which is the red mushroom with the white dots, is almost uncultivatable. Like, people can't grow it indoors. Same with things like chaga. And the reason that they're uncultivatable is because you need a live tree in order for it to have its symbiosis. Anyways, Treasure Coast's from Florida. I got them a while back, and they're really, really, really nice. Like, super nice. First time I took them, I took 0.8, and I went on a hike last summer. And I swear it was such just a beautiful hike, and I was just floating and so happy and just so involved with the trees, and it was just gorgeous. So significantly higher dose, and it was cold outside. So I chose to, you know, do one of my standard routines, which is listening to music in my bed. 100% do recommend that one as well. Even though I think always there's a special place in nature with the mushroom. There's something beautiful about being outside, just being on the ground. Even though that, I still really think, especially for people who are prone to fear and anxiety, one of the easiest places to do it is just in the dark in your room with some music. Like, even at night, you know, like, make it dark and just kind of go into a womb. When I take large amounts, that's my favorite way to start it. And then if I start to get my confidence, then I'll leave my room and I'll go do other things if I can. But sometimes I've just been, it's like, all right, here. So before I ever started microdosing, which, microdosing is taking very small amounts, like a 10th of a gram. Like, you want it to be sublingual. You want it to be not sublingual, subsensible, whatever. You don't want it to fuck you up in any way, shape, or form when you're microdosing. And before that, I used to tell people sarcastically, I'm a macrodoser, because I would literally take like 5 to 7 grams like every weekend, on a Friday, pretty much. And I would just literally take a shit ton of mushrooms and just go sit in my room and like get through it. And a lot of this shit was hard, and I haven't done that in a long time. Like, I don't take more than 3 grams. Like, ever, really. This is one of the largest amounts I've eaten in a long time, and it was only 2.5 grams. And this is what I'm talking about yesterday, when I took 2.5 grams, if you're getting confused. But, yeah, I kicked my butt, and it was lovely. And those Treasure Coasts are just divine. And I've always noticed for, like a 2-3 hour period, it's like a little vacation. And I was just purely just listening to music and feeling waves of unity with our world and with our universe. I was no longer able to think about the past or the present. I wasn't able to plan or lament on mistakes. I didn't have the capacity of forethought or hindsight. And all I had was just that beauty. And I was shocked by how it painted my walls, too. I'm not typically prone to visualizations with this particular hallucinogen, but I saw painted speckles of greens and blues, and my my collection of little trees. What do they call those things? Can't remember right now, but I have a ginseng and I have a euphorbia. And all the leaves were just dancing in my still room, which had no movement. Like in reality, but there was a lot of movement in my eyes. And it's such a beautiful, beautiful thing just to realize our place in it, with it as well. And you have systems of thought, which sometimes are called God consciousness. And I've never been very fond of the baggage that goes with the G word. But unity, synchronicity, I do think that there are levels of existence, as some spiritualists have endured, that we have all these different faces and personalities and ways we can express ourselves and respond to others. But we also have subconsciousness. We have unconsciousness, which unconsciousness is not like nothing. Unconsciousness is consciousness on pause, but our consciousness is still present and there. So it has nothing to do with death when you would assume that death is completely gone. We must all assume that sleep and dreams have nothing to do with death, even though they might be cousins. So then there's not consciousness as well. And a lot of great thinkers that are a lot smarter and have a lot more to give than I do have said that there is something that's not biological, that sits within us, that all the biological has to hold, like a seed holds the shred of life that will turn into a massive tree. But that life, that force of growth, of entropy, of amazingness, that spirit, that to me seems to be our base humanity, and everything else is just painted on it. And we're still riding on that spirit the whole time. Who's to say that after not consciousness comes, that spirit will still be? And a different type of existence that is unwitnessable, undescribable. The Tao that is the Tao cannot be spoken. Yet right now, me and you and every other bit of life is using that same life force with consciousness to perceive itself. Like the universe looking into a mirror is what our ability to think and feel about it is. And how amazing is it that we have this torch to hold and to carry? And sometimes that torch feels like a burden to simply have to be. But it's beautiful, the fact that we have this chance to look around and see reality. And we are that reality. You know? And that's a lot of what this God consciousness kind of idea is. In a way. But you don't have to have an architect. Not to sit on my preaching pedestal. Sometimes I get a little passionate. But just things to think about. Before I go on to some quotations, before I ask Odin how he's doing on this fine Sunday morning, because he's out there playing video games. You know, do you remember Saturday morning TV? Well, weekends are phenomenal for him because he gets usually a couple hours of just freedom. So I'm sure in his head and in his heart right now, he is so content with life. And that's one of the happiest things that a daddy can know. So I want to walk you through this concept. It's called grounding. And I guess you could have two different types. Simple grounding is when you just lay on the ground. If you're ever overwhelmed, just go lay down. Lay down on your back, and as you're laying down, you can do it right now. Here, I'll give you a second. Are you done? You should get a yoga mat if you don't, but even concrete's not too bad for your back and short bends. And then as you're on your ground, start at your feet Feel your heels connecting with the ground. Slowly, slowly move your perception from your heel and go slowly up towards your head and scan your calves and scan the backs of your knees and scan your thighs and scan your tushy. Scan the small of your back and the curve right towards the middle of your back and scan your spinal cord all of the way up to in between your shoulders. Scan the back of your head and look and feel all the hairs touching the ground. And then roll over and start with the other side of your body. And just feel the connection with all the different pieces of your body and with this huge, gigantic earth that we have underneath us. And think about all the other things that are touching this earth and all the other things that are walking around. We always, unless we're running fast, always have a connection through the bottom of our feet with the earth. So that feeling sometimes can bring me home and can bring me out of the ethereal realms of fear and anxiety that exist up in the thought space. Another type of grounding that I was told about in therapy sessions when I was younger is sense-based, and you could do this anywhere, but if you're ever feeling frustrated or if you're ever feeling short or tight or tense, start with your senses and look around and find one object that you can see and look at it in its entirety. Look at all the curves, the color, note the texture, note if it's hanging or touching or suspended or resting on anything else. Then after that, find something that you can hear, even if it's a dead silence, but that's very difficult to find in this reality. Especially if you live around people, you can always hear something going on or some sort of motor or something, even your heart. Then reach out and feel something, feel the actual texture through your kinetic senses and your skin, and then look for a smell and smell something, and then taste your saliva and taste something and or eat something and experience that. And using all of those senses, think about how all those things can only be experienced in the present moment, and you can only collect any of those sensations right here. And that's another form of grounding that I found can get you here. And in both of these methods, the point is to find ourselves back where we always are in this everlasting now. All right. I hope those techniques in some way find some way to help you. I love you. That's why I make the show, is I'm trying to relate and I want to find some way to help. And I hope any of these thoughts in some way find their way to you. My first quotation for you today comes from Ursula Le Guin's compilation of Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching, which is probably one of the books that holds my heart forever, and I'll always be reading it. This is chapter 27, Skill. Good walkers leave no track. Good talkers don't stammer. Good counters don't use their fingers. The best doors unlocked and unopened. The best knots not in a rope and can't be untied. So wise souls are good at caring for people, never turning their back on anyone. They're good at looking after things, never turning their back on anything. There's a light hidden there. Good people teach people who aren't good yet. The less good are the makings of the good. Anyone who doesn't respect a teacher or cherish a student may be clever, but has gone astray. There is a deep mystery there. This makes me think of Socrates in Meno, when he's attempting to teach without teaching. In Meno, he has this commander, Meno, go find a dumb young recruit who is uneducated. And Socrates's intent is that through the act of questioning, he can draw the answer out of the man, even though he doesn't have it. And he uses geometry, like sort of complicated mathematical principles that this kid has never even done any arithmetic. He doesn't even know how to add. And then through a series of questions, the boy is able to come to the conclusion of this complex geometrical math. And I know that it's hard to picture in your head, but just the idea is that we all have the information already, or at least we have the right moral ethic on what to do. Like, our base humanity wants to do the right thing, knows the answer to the equation in this itch. And the act of learning is more of a remembering. And so when we're trying to help people, we don't have to give them much because there's nothing we could give them. We can't give them the answer because under the right circumstances, they already know it. And so in these points, not talking, not giving the answer is far more compelling and is able to have them have a better answer when they find it anyways, you know. So that's what that one made me think about today. The next one comes from Of Water and Spirit. This one is by a African shaman named Maladoma Patrice Somme. It's an autobiography of sorts. But I really enjoyed it. Here we go. This is from the second chapter. His grandfather, who is the spirit man, or like the leader of this tribe within a tribe, it's called the Dagara. And then there's all these different families, like it's like 10,000 people in the Dagara. And so they're all held together by these family links. And his grandfather is the leader of their little family and supposedly has all these magic powers and has the ability to surveil, you know, areas that are like 5 miles away from the house, has all kinds of like roots and is the medicine man. And so he's just died. The miracle completed. All right, I'm gonna go back a little further. Sorry. So I'm gonna summarize a little bit just for context, just so I don't have to read too much. So he has just died, but he's also, after dying, he just sits up ramrod straight like the fucking exorcist. Here we go. The miracle completed, I rushed to him and grabbed his right hand, the one that was free. My father made a movement to stop me, but decided against it. Keeping his authoritative tone, my father spoke to my grandfather in a secret primal language. Grandfather said nothing in response. He just walked out of the room, preceded by my father and followed by the delegation. I walked at his right side, still holding his hand. He moved strangely, too straight, too rigid, unnatural, yet very conscious of any obstacle. Once outside, the crowd joined to make a circle around us. Although I was too young to understand the significance of this ritual or why all these people were not speaking with one another, I was glad to return home with Grandfather, even if he did not seem to want to speak to me. The 4-mile walk took an equal amount of hours. Dead people don't walk very fast. They are not in a hurry. We must have reached home around noontime, for upon our arrival, we were each walking on his own shadow. People were encountered along our way, stopped. They left the road and assumed a somber mood. At home, men and women were everywhere, having come from all directions to wait for Grandfather. Those who had arrived earliest were sitting under the shadows of the trees surrounding the compound. Others stood under the biting sun. Many more were still arriving. When we reached the yard outside the main gate, our delegation stopped. 5 old men came out of the compound and saluted us in mystical terms, each one kneeling down with a grave air. I felt proud to be at the center of so much attention. They murmured something to Grandfather. He continued to be unresponsive, but they did not seem to mind his silence at all. I'm going to stop here for a moment and make a point. Different cultures have different relationships with their death. And I know very well that in a culture of skyscrapers and high technology, dead people don't walk. Instead, they are placed in nice, expensive caskets and driven to the cemetery in elegant black cars. They are put quickly out of sight so that life can go on. Why do the dead walk where I come from? They walk because they are still as important to the living as they were before. They are even more meaningful, as the breadth and depth of our funeral ritual shows. We do not hide their bodies away because we want to see those bodies to help us remember the person's life and all the good they did for us. We need to remember that they are well on their way to becoming an ancestor. We must see our dead so that we can truly mourn them, all the way through, without restraint, to release the grief from our hearts once and for all. Goddamn. For not being a native English speaker, he's so eloquent, and I'm adoring this book right now. Anyways, I'm going to go get home. Thank you so much for your attention. You're important. The show is here for you. You are an amazing being. I can't tell you how grateful I will always be knowing that people like yourselves wake up every morning and take a few breaths.
This is the Gingerbread Man, and what is it again?
Ask O.
Ask O. So I am finally back with more questions for you guys. My question for you, do you like mac and cheese?
Do you like mac and cheese?
Well, mac and cheese is actually not that good for you because it has mostly sugar inside it.
Mmm, it's mainly a lot of fat. A lot of cheese.
Yeah. So you,
I think it's okay for kids.
Like, yeah, it's okay for kids.
But are you saying, like, if a full-grown adult is eating, like, a bunch of mac and cheese, probably not too good?
Yeah, probably not too good for an adult.
No. So what if I just stopped eating everything and only ate mac and cheese from now on?
That'll be bad for you. You'll probably die.
Oh. That escalated quickly. You're a very smart little man. You know that?
Yeah.
Mm. Well, anywho's.
Anywho's?
I don't know. I've been saying it a lot this episode. They're probably pretty irritated with it. Okay. Thank you, guys. I hope you have a wonderful week. Bye.
Yeah.